This KPCC podcast is supported by Center Theater Group, presenting Something Rotten, called The Funniest Thing Since the Book of Mormon. The hit musical comedy begins November 21st. Tickets at AmundsenTheater.org.
Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your Thanksgiving weekend is doing well so far. Coco was our first film up this week from Disney Pixar Animation. We're joined by critics Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor, Amy Nicholson, host of the Canon Podcast, and Charles Solomon, animation critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Charles, why don't you start us off with Coco, which is co-directed by Lee Unkrich and Adrian Molina.
Well, although the bar isn't terribly high, this is the best American animated film of the year. It's Pixar getting back to the top of their game. It's the first time we've had a major American film centered on a Mexican character and Mexican folklore and stories. And I thought it was a terrific film. Miguel is a young kid in a small town in Mexico because his great-great-grandmother was abandoned by her musician husband. She started a shoe business that everyone in the family has worked in ever since, and they're forbidden to play music. Of course, he wants to be a musician to try and solve the mystery of what happened to his great-great-grandmother. He ends up journeying to the land of the dead. It plays off the Day of the Dead celebrations in Mexico, which I knew very little about, and where we're used to angry ghosts and vengeful ghosts and sorrowful ghosts, the idea that these spirits are kind of the summation of the love you had for former relatives and friends is something very different. And they do very interesting things visually, creating the flesh and blood and skeletal versions of his various relatives. So visually, it's really extraordinary. There's a sort of a cat chimera with rainbow feathers. That's I don't know where it came from, but whoever animated it certainly knows how a cat moves. It's gorgeous.
Did you see the 3D or 2D?
I saw 2D. I'd be curious to see how it plays in 3D. There's also skeletons and skulls are not easy to animate because you can't squash and stretch them. So they get around that by doing sort of carving eyebrows and facial decorations and using the dark areas around the eyes to give them stronger expressions. And there's some very, very good animation of a couple of the skeletal characters of the boy and of his grandmother, who was a very redoubtable matriarch, no question. But it's also a film with a lot of heart. I missed it up at the end. Maybe a little long, but just a terrific film. I loved it.
Yeah, Amy, what did you think of Coco?
I miss it up a little bit at the end, too. I mean, as Charles is describing, because at its core, at its skeleton, I guess you could say, this is a story about living skeletons that could be scary for kids. The animators have filled it with color and music and light. It's a really beautiful, cheerful-looking film in an attempt to balance out the more macabre aspects. So you have characters literally popping off their skulls and using them to take selfies. But it's... You see that the filmmakers are trying to make this as approachable of a story as possible, I think, for audiences who aren't familiar with the Day of the Dead. I mean, the character here of Miguel, he's dressed like Elliot from E.T. There's little beats that remind you of Back to the Future. The longer he is in the Day of the Dead, the more his skin starts to vanish. And yet,
And Spirited Away.
And Spirited Away as well. And, you know, as somebody who grew up in San Antonio and was around this culture a little bit more, it really did remind me of home. You know, you see like the giant ofrendas. And there's this beautiful opening sequence they do where they tell the story of his family going back three generations to this grandmother, Imelda, who then opened a shoe emporium. I think the idea of Shoe Queen Imelda is maybe a subtle joke in this film. But they tell this backstory through the Papa Picado banners, those colorful punch card streamers that people see. And they use the colors to kind of tell the story that starts off as a romance and then gets brokenhearted. And it goes from red to pink to win her husband leaves her, it goes to bright, angry red. And it's just very well thought out.
That's so subtle. I didn't even pick up on the color shift with the moods. But that's part of it, too, is that I'm sure that that was communicated even if you weren't conscious of the color shift.
Exactly.
Cinematic mood ring.
Yeah, exactly. Peter, what did you think of Coco?
I liked it a lot. I think it's... It's certainly an improvement over the last couple of Pixar movies, you know, Cars 3 and Finding Dory.
Oh, God, Finding Dory.
You know, I think it's – for me, you know, I agree with all the positive things people have said. For me, it was a little bit too busy in terms of the story. It just seemed like there was maybe a little bit too much going on all the time. And I don't know. I think ultimately for me, the ultimate – test of a family film is maybe, you know, how simple a through line you can have to reach a, you know, a story or moral. But it really does have some heartfelt moments, like you know, one of Hector, the boy's sort of itinerant buddy in the land of the dead. He comes across a friend who's dying, and who literally, you know, sort of
a second time.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Vanishes into the ether because no one remembers him in the land of the living, and that's quite an affecting moment. And there are several moments that are like that, and the visuals are really quite, you know, eye popping in a lyrical way, not just, you know, wow, like the bridge to the land of the living has
marigold petals,
you know, sort of bright yellow. I mean, it was really quite extraordinary.
It looked like Christo's bridge to me. It was that bright crystal.
Yeah, they
color.
Also, you know, we've had a couple of other films try and use Day of the Dead imagery. And if you have one of those sugar skulls with the colored icing all around it, it's kind of cool. If you have a whole wall of them, your eye can't focus because there's so much detail and so much color. And they sort of – they use light to sort of layer things so that the land of the dead doesn't become oppressive. And when you look down at the bases of the buildings, you can see there are Aztec motifs. And then they go up to the sort of 19th century Victorian world that is most of the land of the dead. And lots of interesting visual work in this film.
I think the animators were faced with a challenge that they mostly met, not entirely for me, which is you have all these, you know, quote, dead people and skeletons in this movie. How do you animate them in such a way that they're not only not scary but embracing? And, you know, I think I wonder if kids, you know, like under the age of 6 or so might be off-put by some of it because – at least I know that it's very much in the Mexican culture that the Day of the Dead is considered a celebration of one's ancestors and so forth. I found it hard sometimes to separate out, as I do in many depictions of the Day of the Dead, you know, John Huston's Under the Volcano and many others, you know, separating out my intrinsic, fear and disturbance for these images with what is being presented. And I think that in this film, they do a very good job most of the time of making you forget all that and feeling comfortable around all of this.
Peter, I know one thing that some of the animators have talked about, particularly for the Hector character, they looked at old films of marionettes to get that kind of jangly feeling.
I can see that, definitely. Yeah.
You know,
that
wasn't the Silly Symphonies with Skeleton Dance?
That was the first Silly Symphony.
The very first Silly, yeah.
Well, yeah, well, this reminded me a lot of like that 40s Disney style of the skeletons that you would see in Fantasia, and also of Walt Disney's own really interest in this in South America and Central America with Three Caballeros, which is one of my favorite early Disney cartoons.
I thought the music also was very effectively done. There are a number of original songs that are written for the film. Michael Giacchino wrote the original score for the film. And since music is at the heart of it, I thought it was quite effectively done.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, they make this really jazzy rendition of La Llorona. That's not at all like the version I know. But
nightclub version of La Llorona.
I'm kind of dreading, though, the inevitable underproduced or overproduced Oscar number for best original song that they're going to do. You know, I can see it now.
We're talking about Coco, Disney Pixar's new animated film, directed by Lee Unkrich and Adrian Molina. Molina co-wrote the screenplay with Matthew Aldrich. It's rated PG in wide release. release in both 3D and 2D screenings. The man who invented Christmas tells the story of Charles Dickens' creation of A Christmas Carol. The movie stars Dan Stevens, Christopher Plummer, and Jonathan Pryce. Barrett Nulary is the director, and the screenwriter Susan Coyne. Amy, what'd you think of The Man Who Invented Christmas?
I guess I would describe it as the more Christmassy, slightly sillier version of Shakespeare in Love, starring Charles Dickens. You have a story here about a man with writer's block. This film takes place at the point in his career where he had been the biggest thing going. He was on a string of flops, and now Charles Dickens has a mortgage, a kid on the way, in addition to the other millions of kids he already has. He's spending too much money, and he's not getting that much back, so he needs a hit. He's getting negged by the people in his writer community who are saying, you know, oh yes, I heard about your little last book. Shame nobody read it. I'm so sorry about the reviews. So he starts to try to come up with a surefire hit. And you just, it's one of those movies structured around the idea that every single interaction he has, whether it's with their new Irish maid or with a funeral he bumps into on the street, becomes a piece of what's going to be A Christmas Carol.
A waiter
which we
named
all know
Marley.
Is going to be a waiter named Marley, who has a ghostly voice. It gets, to me, a little bit goofy and name-checky and oppressive. It's that sort of thing where you're supposed to feel smart forgetting what the reference mm-hmm. is more than enjoying the film itself. And to the point that you finally have Christopher Plummer show up as Scrooge, the character, this externalization of how it is to write a book, and him just sitting in his room yelling at him. And to me, what worked best in that dynamic is just when Charles Dickens has to realize that maybe he's more Scrooge-like than he thinks he is, that he's kind of been a bit selfish himself.
Well, I agree with Amy that it's trying to be Shakespeare in Love, but without the erudition or wit. I mean, Dickens was, even despite his failures, the most celebrated writer in the English language. He did not go to an Irish parlor maid and ask whether or not Tiny Tim should die. He did not get the idea of writing a ghost story from her. In fact, if you read the Pickwick Papers, there's when Mr. Pickwick goes away for Christmas, he hears the story of when Gabriel Grubb, sexton and gravedigger who is nasty at Christmas time, a troop of goblins kidnaps him, shows him scenes that, you know, and saying, look at how other people celebrate this time of year, including a poor family whose youngest child dies. So he was basically doing a rewrite. You know, I don't think Dickens was ever blocked. And again, if he did, he didn't go to the maid for advice.
So you couldn't suspend disbelief and just
I mean, I adore Shakespeare in Love. I would love to see Romeo and Ethel, the pirate's daughter, but not this.
Peter?
Yeah, this is a pretty mediocre movie. You know, it's plottingly directed, indifferently acted. The conception is borderline offensive for all the reasons we've discussed about Dickens. You know, I guess they're trying to promote this as a perennial holiday movie, but no way. The only good thing about this movie was I saw it at a screening at the Arrow on a double bill with Alistair Sims' Christmas Carol.
Wow.
Which is far and away the best of the Christmas Carol movies and a really wonderful movie and only 65 minutes to boot. So see that instead of this.
Is Amy, final word on The Man Who Invented Christmas?
Yeah, I think Peter about sums it up. Although I will say, to its credit, there are big banquet spreads of puddings that made me very hungry and wish I could have a British Christmas.
Bring you some figgy pudding. The Man Who Invented Christmas, Dan Stevens, Christopher Plummer, and Jonathan Pryce star. It's rated PG and in selected theaters. Call Me By Your Name, set in northern Italy back in the early 1980s. Armie Hammer stars. Luca Guadagnino is the director of the film. James Ivory is the screenwriter. Peter, why don't you start us off?
This is a very languorous movie that is beautiful to watch. It's you know, set in the northern Italian countryside, and the director is very good at capturing atmospherics and sort of, you know, lazy, hazy days and all of that stuff. And I think that is sort of the most interesting thing about the movie, because the relationship between the young boy and Armie Hammer's character progresses sort of incrementally. At first, they're kind of wary of each other, and Armie Hammer is sort of, you know, flip, and he's a ladies' man, and but there's an attraction there that I think, you know, does hold some interest in the film in terms of how it's dealt with it, very non-judgmentally. You know, for this kind of movie, there isn't a whole lot of moralizing or anything like that. There's a very good scene at the end after, you know, the two have separated, where the father of the boy, played by Michael Stuhlbarg, you know, basically says, we know what's going on, and it's okay. But I think there isn't enough heft with the two characters to really provide any kind of depth of character to make this more interesting than a...
We'll continue with Call Me By Your Name back in 1 minute on Film Week. Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Charles Solomon, Amy Nicholson, and Peter Rayner. The Film Independent Spirit Award put out their nominees for their year-end honors. We're talking about one of those nominated for Best Feature, Call Me By Your Name. Peter Rayner starting us off talking about the film, which is set in Northern Italy in 1983, story of a 17-year-old boy who begins a relationship with his father's visiting research assistant, Armie Hammer, and Timothée Chalamet are the stars of the film, which is directed by Luca Guadagnino. Amy, what do you think of Call Me By Your Name?
Well, I've watched this film twice now because it's very high on a lot of people's top 10 lists. A lot of critics I love have placed it as their number one film of the year. So I thought, I need to figure out what people love about this. Is there something missing in my heart? And what I've decided is it's a really, really lovely film. You want to live inside of this film. You want to live inside, as Peter was saying, like this Italian countryside where all the tables are filled with wine. And above all the people sitting at the tables are the smartest people on the planet. Everyone's charming and knows everything about Beethoven. People get into arguments about the etymology of the word apricot. You know, this is a place you'd want to
Greco-Roman be. Greco-Roman antiquities is real
yes.
big in this film.
Exactly. You know, it's a film that makes you feel smart. And if it's a film that feels a little bit infatuated with itself. And I can't fault it for that. To me, my favorite thing about this film, which I think is fine, it's great, I hope people go see it, is just Armie Hammer himself. Because he's been one of my favorite underdog actors for a long time. He seems like a strange underdog because he's tall, he's handsome, he's funny, he's charming, he's very intelligent. And yet I think because of movies like Zorro, nobody's really given him a chance. He's so good in this as a man who just enters the screen, you know, huge and tall and crammed into tiny European cars that don't fit him, takes up so much space, is always drinking and eating apricot juice and eggs. And he is terrific in this. He's so funny. And if anything good comes out of this film, besides the fact that I think people should see it and would like it, hopefully more than I do, it's that Armie Hammer needs to be in every movie. He's really fantastic.
Well, you must have really liked Social Network because he's playing twins in this. Two Armie Hammers.
I'll be honest. I liked him in Zorro.
Call Me By Your Name, Charles.
This falls under the heading of it's really beautiful, but so's a calendar, and you only have to look at a calendar for a month. You know, I agree with Amy. I want to move into that villa. You know, it has everything but Palladio's signature on it, or the orchard next to it. But this film moves at just a glacial pace. I think it's over an hour before the two characters actually start to get together. And you're thinking, geez. So it's very pretty, but I wouldn't see why it's on somebody's top 10 list except for the scene.
And when they do get together, I mean, I hate to sound like a screenwriting instructor, but the film needs more conflict. You know, I mean, it's there isn't quite enough conflict going on.
I'll tell you what. I'll call you Charles and you call me Peter.
Okay.
Call
Me By Your Name is the film. It's rated R. You can see it at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Darkest Hour, the story of Winston Churchill as newly appointed British Prime Minister. Gary Oldman plays him. Lily James, Kristen Scott Thomas, co-star. Joe Wright directed from a screenplay by Anthony McCartan. Amy?
Well, if you're looking for another double feature this week, you could watch Darkest Hour right after your screener of Dunkirk. I mean, this is the companion story that takes place from inside Parliament as new Prime Minister Winston Churchill, played by Gary Oldman, who is completely unrecognizable. He's under cheeks and chins and guzzling tons of fake booze in every single scene and waddling into frame.
Fake booze?
Fake booze. No actor could handle any of what Winston was taking on. And telling us in a story that I didn't quite know from the British point of view about the weeks leading up to the Battle of Dunkirk when Churchill, he's very new. He's been in office only a few weeks. And other members of parliament are hoping to sign a treaty with the Nazis to create peace with Adolf Hitler. And they make a convincing point to many of the people in office that why do we want to send little young boys to die? And there are scenes where Winston Churchill on the other side has to say, well, let's give up that garrison in order to maybe get these kids off the beach. And the film doesn't shy away from the weight of that. However, the film does feel a little bit just old-fashioned. It's a little bit stodgy. It's very classic Oscar winner biopic style. And because of that, I had a hard time warming to it as much as I was interested in the story that they were telling.
What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of this film. I think it's very stodgy and old-fashioned in ways that aren't terribly interesting. If not for Gary Oldman's performance, I'm not sure that there'd be a whole lot going on in this film. Forgive me, I don't recall the name of the makeup artist. He's Japanese who did the work for Gary Oldman, who's the best in the biz and only works rarely. But when I thought, Gary Oldman playing Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
I know he's played Beethoven and Lee Harvey Oswald and everybody, but still. And it's a marvelous, makeup.
Transformation,
yeah. And it's a very entertaining performance, but it doesn't give you anything more than a filled out caricature of, it says, we will fight them on the beaches, there's a lot of that stuff. There's a lot of, the strong woman and, Clemmy Churchill, who's the power behind this man, and, the cowering secretary who's worried, that she's going to chew her out, but he's really a sweetheart. There's one very dubious scene where he's on the underground going to parliament, he's figuring out what he should say, whether they should appease or fight to the end. And he sort of canvasses the people in the subway, what would you do if Hitler? And they'll say, never, never. There's this 8-year-old girl goes, never. And so I guess that made it okay. I mean, he's okay. You know what? I'm not going to appease him.
I'm 99% sure that scene didn't happen in real life.
Apparently, it did not. No.
I have to have a little bit of me though. Went, God, I wish our politicians cared what the ordinary people thought.
Very briefly, Brian Cox played Churchill in the movie Churchill earlier this year, and it was a very creditable performance. Not to mention John Lithgow in the TV series, or Michael Gambon in a British this two years ago.
Who was it in The King's Speech?
We'll get that for you. Darkest Hour is the film, directed by Joe Wright, starring Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. Anthony McCarden wrote the screenplay, rated PG-13 at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Thelma is directed by Joachim Trier, who co-wrote the screenplay with Eskil Vogt. The movie is unrated. Peter?
I kind of like this movie. It's a very elusive, semi-scary movie about this young student who she's studying in Oslo, and she has these seizures that are unexplained. They try to figure out what it is, and it's never really clear in the end what it is. But it allows her to sort of be vaguely telekinetic or whatever. And there's a certain aspect of Carrie in this movie. She develops, a kind of sexual fixation on a fellow a student who she is reciprocated, and it's all very dreamy and weird and not altogether explainable. But I think it does stay with you. I think there's a certain hauntingness to the movie that doesn't always exist for these kind of supernatural erotic thrillers.
What'd you think of it, Amy?
Yeah, Norwegian Carrie, I think, is exactly right. You've got the conservative religious parents.
West Coast Barbie? Or
Malibu Barbie.
Well, you just made it all West Coast. That just takes care of a lot of trees. It's got the repression ideas that manifest in these telekinetic ways. It opens with a really striking scene where young Thelma is a girl walking through the woods with her father hunting. And without her seeing, he ends up pointing the rifle at her and then deciding not to pull the trigger. And the rest of the film tries to get to the moment of why a dad would even consider doing that to the young girl. What is he so afraid of with her? And to me, the film got very slow towards the end, but there's some really beautiful camera work in here. The director, you know, Joachim Trier, he does these things with like inky blackness behind characters, or they seem to be floating in this midnight space. It's really beautiful and very moody and atmospheric. He's been making a lot of films already. He's no new filmmaker, even though he's a fairly young guy. This makes me want to keep seeing his films, even though I feel like the central character herself is a little bit of one of those big-eyed, stoic, slender heroines who's a little dull, even though the film around her isn't quite as bad.
Thelma is the film. The movie is unrated. It's playing at the Lemley Playhouse Pasadena, the Monica Film Center Santa Monica, and the AMC Dine-In Sunset in West Hollywood. Thelma is unrated. A Gray State, a documentary that looks at the deaths of Iraq war veteran David Crowley and his wife and child. Crowley was in the process of making a film called Gray State at the time. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, this is a documentary about a really interesting story that isn't quite as interesting as the story itself. As backstory, what Gray State is there's a really young, late 20-something military vet, who decided that he was going to make a film that exposes everything about the system. He's one of those Rand Paul, FEMA's poisoning us all, conspiracy theorist guys. But he really did earn his cynicism, you know, on the ground as a soldier, seeing atrocities happen. And he brought that back and channeled it into wanting to make this film to reveal the truth. Now, in revealing the truth, he made some dubious friends. Alex Jones is one of them, also just the internet at large. And when he fundraises to make the film, the internet at large gets mad that the film isn't being made fast enough. And about a third of the way into the film, it's revealed that he never made it because he wound up killing himself and his wife and his daughter. And the director tries to get out at why, which to me isn't quite as successful as I want it to be. But the story itself is one that I've been curious about ever since it happened a few years ago.
All right. A Gray State is the film, the documentary at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. It's unrated. Porto, a new drama starring Anton Yelchin and Lucy Lucas. This is one of the final films of the late Anton Yelchin. Gabe Klinger is the director. Larry Gross co-wrote the screenplay with him. Amy?
Yeah, this is a romance that's a little twisted about a young man who's in Portugal meets a beautiful, slightly older woman who's a little bit damaged. They have a one-night affair, and then the film skips around forward in time when they reconnect when they're slightly older to explain what happened, why it didn't work out. What the film doesn't quite explain is why should it have worked out in the first place, because the lead character is, to me, one of those balding, pretentious jerks that you just don't really want to give the time of day to anyways. He's not good enough for her from the beginning. You know, it's a film with a lot of pathos, mainly because of Anton Yelchin himself. He was a young actor who I really, really loved ever since I first saw him in the film, whose name I just absolutely blanked out, but it has Justin Timberlake and it's really fantastic. So to watch him in this film get older because it ages him up made me very, very sad because I wish we had gotten to see that in him. But this film didn't work on me at all. It's very pretentious.
All right. Yeah. What'd you think, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of over arty and has all sorts of allusions to French New Wave and, you know, Hiroshima Mon Amour and many other films of that ilk. But it's not sustained by the characters, who I think are much thinner than, you know, would work for this kind of movie. But yeah, Anton Yelchin was a great loss, you know. I mean, and like Crazy, it's not that similar in terms of storyline to this, but there are certain similarities, you know, with a couple that fall apart. And that's something you should go back and see if you really want to see him at his best.
And Alpha Dog, that's the movie whose name I couldn't
Alpha
forget.
Alpha Dog, yeah.
He's amazing.
Very good.
Yeah.
You pulled that out. Porto is the film.
Timothy Spall played Winston Churchill.
Yes, yes. Porto is the film we're talking about at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. The movie is unrated. Also want to invite you to come join us at the theater at Ace Hotel Saturday night, December 16th. It's our next Film Week screening in our ongoing series of films set in Los Angeles. Die Hard for the holidays. What can be better? The blowout of Century City. We'll look forward to your joining us. 7 o'clock Saturday night, December 16th. Tickets at kpecc.org/in-person.
The Matt Bash of Americans is back with a brand new season, and we are pumped to be back with the fam. Listen as Randall Park learns about his dad's bachelor days, and Maz Jobrani remembers the strangeness of being both American and Iranian in the 1980s. We also have a Cambodian refugee talking to her daughter about the joy of discovering a pair of awesome bell-bottoms at the food bank, and we rediscover the flavors of San Gibbons past and present. We laugh, we cry, and we ask really awkward questions. Hear the future of America right now. Subscribe at applepodcast.com/mashup and get us in your ears weekly. Ciao.
This KPCC podcast is supported by Center Theater Group, presenting Something Rotten. With 10 Tony nominations, including Best Musical, the New York Post says Something Rotten is a big, fat hit. This hilarious new show tells the story of two brothers who are desperate to write their own hit play, while the rock star Shakespeare keeps getting all the hits. When a local soothsayer foretells that the future of theater involves singing, dancing, and acting at the same time, the brothers set out to write the world's very first musical. With its heart on its ruffled sleeve and sequins in its soul, New York Magazine says Something Rotten is the producers plus Spamalot plus the Book of Mormon squared. Begins November 21st. Tickets at AmundsenTheater.org.
Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, we'll talk with the composer of Coco, the new Pixar animated feature. Michael Giacchino will be with us in just a few minutes on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. And we remind you, we come your way over the air every Friday at 11, every Saturday at noon. But you can also hear us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. Well, the re-release of the 1936 Jean Renoir film, The Crime of Monsieur Lange, coming to Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Peter, tell us why this film is so worthy of seeing on a big screen.
Because it's directed by Jean Renoir. No, I mean, you know, Renoir is one of the, you know, two or three greatest directors in the history of cinema. This is a wonderful, wonderful movie by him. I would say his three greatest are Grand Illusion, Rules of the Game, and Day in the Country. This is in the second tier of Renoir, which means it's better than just about any movie that was ever made. And it was written by Jacques Prévert, who is a wonderful screenwriter. He wrote many of the Carnet classics, including Children of Paradise and Le Jour se lève. It's a double whammy to have both of these guys involved in this film. And it was made in 1936, not long before the Popular Front and the progressive politics came into France, and then of course the war came in. There's a certain socialist aspect to the movie where the members of the publishing house form a cooperative when their evil boss leaves because he doesn't want to face creditors, and then the boss comes back. Wonderful actor named Jules Berry. Disguised as a priest to get his share of the profits from Monsieur Lange's pulp Western novels, you know, featuring Arizona Jim. It's a wonderful movie. It's so funny and well acted and beautifully directed. You know, deep focus photography, folks, before Citizen Kane. It really demands to be seen on a big screen.
The Crime of Monsieur Lange from 1936, re-released at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The movie's unrated. 1945, a Hungarian film that's directed by Ferenc Tarok. Peter, what'd you think?
This is a very good movie. It's set right after the end of World War II in Hungary, and the inhabitants of this village informed on and gave up many of the Jews who lived in the village during the occupation, and now two Jews, an elderly man and his son apparently have reentered the village for somewhat mysterious circumstances, and everyone in the village goes nuts because they think that they're there to reclaim their home that was taken away from them and their possessions, etc. So it's kind of a parable and a little bit like High Noon too, because you know everyone in the village is singled out for one transgression or another, and they're in such fear of what's going to happen that they basically self-destruct without really even knowing why the two Jewish people are there, which turns out to be for, you know, more benign reason than they thought. So it's shot in black and white, and it's a very good film.
It's 1945 Hungarian film at Lemley's Royal West L.A., Lemley's Town Center in Encino, and it's unrated. I want to raise the issue of the head of Pixar stepping aside for 6 months because John Lasseter's had such a huge effect, not just on that now division of Disney, but Disney animation overall, which he has significantly improved during the time that he has headed that as well as Pixar. He's stepping away for 6 months for what he says are missteps in his conduct. There have been allegations about inappropriate conduct with women who work for Pixar and for Disney. Charles, I just want to ask you about the significance of Lasseter's effect and how big the effect you think is going to be on the company with his absence.
I mean, Lasseter is so involved in everything. He's got such sharp eyes. And, for example, when they brought in for Toy Story 3 the new model of Buzz Lightyear, he spent an entire afternoon going over it detail by detail to make sure that, yes, you can improve that, but you can't change it too much. That said, Pixar has an extraordinarily strong bench. You know, their brain trust, which they insist has to be said with air quotes. Okay, you've got Pete Docter, Brad Bird, Andrew Stanton, Lee Unkrich. Just to start off with, that's 7 Oscars right there.
A lot of talent.
Yeah, they've got excellent story people. They've got very strong producers. They've got talented visual artists. They will get along. I'm sure they'll miss him. It must be very disruptive because John is extremely gregarious, is never happier than when he's talking with people and working on working in down and dirty in the films with him. It's got to be very demoralizing, but I think they have strong enough people and works going on that, they're going to make it. Their next film is Brad Bird's The Incredibles 2. The one sequel I think everybody's really been waiting for.
Wait, next summer we're supposed to get it right.
Yes.
But Toy Story 4, I don't know. Maybe they should have left it at 3.
3 was pretty great, though. Yeah.
No, and I think that there, I know a lot of the artists there, you know, who sort of off the record are eager to get on to new films.
Off the record? You're on the record.
I'm not saying who, but, Coco and Inside Out were really terrific films. And that's what I think the Pixar artists are happier doing, following in Walt's footsteps, who never wanted to do sequels. He had to be really bullied by his distributor into going back to the Three Little Pigs and, famously said, you can't top pigs with pigs. similarly, Disney also has a pretty deep bench with, John Musker and Ron Clements and Jennifer Lee and the people who've been making the recent films that have done so well. But when your leader leaves you in this sort of situation, it's going to be chaotic. It's going to be hard. But I think you have to trust those artists who have given us so many good films in recent years and let them do it. Let them do it.
And of course, the disposition of any allegations here is also going to have a big effect because it'll determine whether he comes back or not. Whether that's divisive, Amy.
Yeah, I can't help wondering because this company has been Lasseter's for so long, if there is any connection between the fact that this company hasn't actually been that supportive to female voices and female artists. Most notably, they took Brave away from Brenda Chapman, and they didn't even have their first female protagonist until Inside Out. And I wonder, maybe with him being gone for 6 months or longer, maybe there will be a chance for female artists to come into that vacuum and for the Pixar to mix up their storytelling.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's entirely fair, though, because, for example, many of their producers are women. Many of their key artists and department heads are women. There are few women directors. I think part of the reason for that is it takes anywhere from 3 to 5 years to make one of these films. There simply aren't that many directorial slots.
Maybe there will be more space, though, for people to rise up in the company.
Maybe. I don't know. But they've also been one that's been very open to minorities. I mean, co-director of Coco is Adrian Molina, Ronnie Del Carmen on Inside Out. Peter Soans directed a couple of – I mean, there are a lot of Asian and Latino and female artists at Pixar who are important, though, again, there have not been women directors. You know, that point is well taken.
I just say, you know, with all due respect to Walt, that you can top Pigs with Pigs. Bay Pig in the City, I believe, is every
great
bit as great as Babe.
Yeah. Rashida Jones, by the way, left Toy Story 4, and there she responded in Time magazine article today to speculation that she had left because of conduct alleged by John Lasseter. She said, no, it did not have anything to do with any form of sexual misconduct, but that her feeling was that there were philosophical differences and that Pixar wasn't really embracing of women and minority employees within Pixar animation. So at least for her, she's got the critique, Amy, that you just mentioned, that she didn't feel it was an inclusive enough environment. Tear Talk, Film Week on KPECC, Larry Mantle with our critics. Coming up, we talk with Michael Giacchino, who wrote the original score for Coco, the Pixar film, which opens over this Thanksgiving weekend. We'll talk with him about the Mexican themes of the music. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Crossing the Marigold Bridge, original music composed for the Pixar film Coco, which takes us to Mexico for Dia de los Muertos. 12-year-old Miguel longing to be a musician, but his family forbids it. That opens the door for the movie to be filled with music. We're joined by the composer of Coco's original score, Michael Giacchino, Oscar winner, by the way, for Up in 2010. Michael, great to have you with us again on Film Week.
Hey, Larry, how are you doing?
Great. I'm doing great. How much time did you and other members of the musical team spend studying Mexican music, even visiting Mexico?
You know, it's usually on a film, you come in at the very end, but this was one of those films, because it was so entrenched in music, I was in way earlier than that. And I was paired up with a couple of experts in Mexican music, Camilo Lara and Germaine Franco, It was amazing to have these guys at my disposal, because anything that I needed or had questions about, I had them to just call. You know, I grew up listening to all kinds of music, and my dad had this, you know, couple of records called the Music of Mexico, and I used to love them. So when I came into this project, I thought, okay, I know so much about Mexican music, only to find out, wow, I don't know anything compared to what the landscape truly is. And it's a vast landscape. It's pretty amazing.
Now, Germaine and Adrian co-wrote original songs for the production as well. And that's not unusual for you to have that experience with films. But does that present particular challenges, or how do you write in and out of so that your music accompanies the original songs written by others?
Well, hopefully those songs are kind of moments within the film that stand on their own. And then I can kind of lead up to them and then come out of them. And, you know, my concern and my job at this is always following the character's stories, the character's emotions. I'm the subtext of the movie. I'm not necessarily what's on the face of the character. I'm what's in the heart of the character. So I'm always trying to track that. You know, and these songs are sort of their own little thing. And Bobby and Kristen Lopez wrote an incredible song called Remember Me for the film, which is really kind of comes in and out quite a bit. But as far as my score was sticking with Miguel, sticking with all of the different characters in the film, and making sure that the audience is with them emotionally throughout the whole story.
And when you're coming up with the particular musical themes that you use for characters, how early are you brought into that process to try and identify what the sound is of the character's inner life?
Well, for me, I generally love to watch the movie and then just reflect on how it made me feel. and I think about the different characters. And, you know, and my job is not unlike being an actor, where I have to sort of take on these emotions of these characters. You have to go deep and, you know, for and think about what is it about Miguel that resonates with me, that I believe that is inside of him. And then I try and search for that, that musical equivalent. And it's always searching. You're always like, you're, you know, going, sitting down at the piano the very first time after seeing one of these films is always a little daunting, because you know you're going to have to go somewhere emotionally, that it could be sad, it could be angry, it could be any number of things, but you have to go there to truthfully sort of create a sound that echoes what the what's in the characters' hearts. You know, the other thing about coming on this film much earlier than I normally would have was writing music that we recorded in Mexico, which was crazy. It was really fun. And I got to write a lot of music that you would hear on the street, you know, as characters are running down the street or things are happening. We wanted it to feel like you were really there. So I wrote a lot of music that was recorded down in Mexico to give that flavor and to give that truthfulness to the story we wanted to tell.
We're talking with Oscar-winning composer Michael Giacchino. I had an incredibly memorable experience of, at Michael's invitation, visiting the huge soundstage at the old MGM, now Sony Studios, and standing there as he conducted the orchestra. This was for the score of the film John Carter. And it's one of the most memorable experiences musically I've ever had. You work with big orchestras, Michael, and I'm wondering, did you add any different instruments or any other musicians than you would typically use?
Well, the great thing about my orchestra, and you saw a lot of them in action that day when we were there for John Carter, was so many of my musicians are Latino. They're specifically Mexican. They're, you know, I've been working with these guys forever. So when this job came around, everyone was like, this is going to be so much fun, because they really could delve into their roots, you know, and there were a lot of people within the orchestra already that really had that experience. Abe Laboriel, my bass player.
Oh, yeah, great bassist.
Yeah. Oh, he's like one of the greatest on the planet, born in Mexico City, you know. A lot of Latin American guys, you know, like Alex Acuna, who was the drummer on Weather Report. I mean, these are guys that have been around forever and all over the world. So this was the level of people I'm able to work with, which is always an incredible gift to me. And as you saw, when you put music in front of these people, they just play it. There's no rehearsal. They just, no matter what you put in front of them, they play it, you know, and they know how to do it expertly, and they can change it on a dime if need be. But we added, we used lots of traditional Mexican instruments. We even had this thing called the Aztec death whistle, which is an ancient, you know, sort of whistle, which gives you this really eerie sound, and we used it for particular moments in the movie. So wherever we could, we brought in people and instruments that made sense, that made it feel indigenous, that made it feel truthful to the country, and really celebrated everything that country has to offer.
Michael, is there any difference whatsoever in scoring an animated versus live action film?
In my mind, no difference at all, because you're still dealing with characters, right? If I'm, say I'm working on Star Trek and I have Chris Pine in front of me, he's a real person, but I'm still dealing with the character he's creating. And it's no different than if I have Remy. You know, Remy the rat from Ratatouille is no different from Chris Pine on the Bridge of the Enterprise. It's all pretend, and it's all a story. So I treat them each equally. I treat any of the animated characters as I would if they were a human standing in front of me.
We're talking with Michael Giacchino, the Oscar-winning composer of so many great films. You mentioned Star Trek. He's done the rebooted Star Trek films. He's worked very often with director J.J. Abrams. He's also composed a majority of Pixar's films and known for so many of the terrific scores that he's done, including you're working on Incredibles 2. Have you started work on that yet?
I am just about to start working on that. In fact, actually, you should come back to that session.
I would be so honored. Please.
That is the one you really want to see, because the whole, these guys, these jazz players, and just seeing them do what they do, it's a blast. So let's.
I'm there. I'll play hooky for that. Michael, thank you. Really a pleasure. Appreciate it. Congratulations again on another outstanding score.
Thank you so much, Larry. Thanks for having me.
All right. Michael Giacchino with us as we go out from Coco, the brand new Pixar animated feature, Dia de los Muertos Suite from Coco. From all of us here at Film Week, we wish you a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. We're with you every Friday at 11 and Saturday at noon for Film Week here on KPECC.